Radiotopia.
I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a new season. Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons and have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships in prison, and incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Pooja. I work behind the scenes on the Mortified podcast. The following is a very special best of episode, originally produced as an hour-long radio program. You might notice a few elements that are unique to radio shows, and you'll hear versions of performances from some of our favorite episodes. Anyway, we had so much fun making it that we thought we'd share it here, with you. And now, Mortified's totally juvenile election special.
Dear Diary.
Sixth grade.
February 14th.
1991.
I am really depressed.
How could she break up with me?
Mom, you can't read this.
You're listening to Mortified's Totally Juvenile Election Special from PRX and Radiotopia. For the makers of the Mortified podcast, I'm Dave.
November 1st, 1992.
That's Stephen Chapaska reading his teenage journal on stage at Mortified, a storytelling project where adults share their most embarrassing childhood writings in front of total strangers. As a high schooler, he had already grown sick and tired of election season, and he hadn't even reached voting age yet.
The election of 1992 is 2 days away. I cannot wait to see the end of this infamous presidential race. The campaign has fatigued me. I would love it if Bill Clinton won. If Ross Perot wins, fine.
Of course, campaign malaise isn't just limited to teenagers in 1992. It's something that all of us can identify with, especially these days.
I think there comes a point in every campaign where everybody's just sick of it. The public and everyone else involved is just exhausted.
That's NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith.
In other countries, the election cycle is very short. In America, the election cycle is constant, in part because it's entertainment, but it does get to a point where people tune it out.
Having covered politics for years, she's had a front row seat to the effects of relentless campaigns.
The stress on a campaign is incredible. I once interviewed Howard Dean, and he said that when he was running for president in 2004, he didn't even recognize himself in that person. He saw himself as being sort of a peaceful, wonky guy from Vermont, and he ended up running as this sort of aggressive bomb thrower type of candidate. The thing of running for president, the environment, after a while, that just gets to you. Someone else is mocking you and giving you a mean nickname. You're talking about the size of someone's hands or whether they sweat or whether they wet their pants.
It's enough to make someone in her shoes ask, "Where have I seen this before?"
This was literally the kind of thing I remember from elementary school.
This hour, in honor of the ridiculous similarities between elections and adolescence, we're taking a detour from the official campaign trail and heading back in time through the pages of the past to answer just one question. What can we learn from the strange campaigns we waged as kids?
Tuesday, August 16th, Bush picked a running mate. His name is Dan Quayle, and he's from Indiana, Senator. He's good-looking and energetic. Beats Benson anyway.
That's Ari Scott sharing her teenage journals at Mortified, and her excitement demonstrates just how important it is for candidates to select a running mate.
It just comes down to chemistry.
Once again, here's Tamara.
If you look at 2012, Mitt Romney, there were lots of options of people that he could choose, but ultimately he chose Paul Ryan as his running mate because they got along together, because they made each other better, which is just like a relationship.
Coming of age in the mid-1980s, Ari could relate. She spent her days, like most girls, dreaming of finding her own special someone. Then one day she discovered the boy of her dreams and had not just a sexual awakening, but a political one too. There was just one hitch. Technically, he didn't exist.
The passion to be a Republican, for me, came from family ties and liking the character of Alex P. Keaton, even though I knew it was a comedy. I think I took that character more seriously than it probably was intended to be.
And while Alex wasn't real, her love for him was. So Ari waged a campaign to find someone just like him. She chronicled that pursuit in her teenage journals.
Okay, first page of my diary has my name, Ariana Scott, address, Northport, New York. And then party, I wrote Republican, conservative, anti-commie. And then I wrote in big letters on the front page, I can tell that you snuck in here. Look at yourself snooping around my diary, and you call yourself an American. You sneaky, vomitous slob. Tuesday, November 8th, 1988. This morning, Vanessa gave me a Bush button, and I wore it all day. I talked to Evan today. Here's our conversation. Me sitting at desk. Evan holding up Bush button. Bush. Evan smiling. Yeah, Bush. Ari, where'd you get that button? Me. Oh, Vanessa brought like 20 to school. Evan. Oh. Monday, in math. Me. Hey, Evan, I found out that Bush and Quayle are related. They're 10th cousins. Evan, raising eyebrows. Really? Jennifer. Wait, Ari, where'd you hear that? Me. On the radio this morning. I swear, then to Evan, they're also related to Abraham Lincoln. Evan, are they allowed to do that? Wednesday, November 9th. First of all, Bush is not the actual president until January 20th. But boy, what a great day. I am so glad Evan is for Bush. Here are our conversations. In math, he said, Bush, and we smiled at each other. Then in English, Evan and Scott were talking about Bush and Dukakis, and I was watching them, and Evan looked at me and said, Bush. And I made a fist and said, yeah, or Bush. But the biggie came while we were walking out of the band storage room. Me holding up Bush bumper sticker. Evan. Evan. Bush. Me. I went with my mom to vote. She voted for Dukakis. Evan. Oh. You were in the voting booth with your mom? Me. Well, I was just sticking my head in, but yeah, my whole family was in there, all my sisters. Evan. That's illegal, you know. Me. It is? Are you sure? Evan. Yeah, it's illegal. Me. Shrugged. Oh, well. Bye.
The 1988 campaign proved to be bittersweet for Ari. Her candidates won the election, but her campaign to win over the cutest boy in school resulted in loss. And eventually, things changed, including her politics.
I've always loved Alex P. Keaton. I still love that character. But by the time I entered college, I had probably let go of that wanting to be like him. I was more hippie-ish and left-leaning. Maybe in a way, I eventually became more like Stephen and Elise Keaton.
Now, there's a grand tradition in politics. Frame yourself as an outsider and rally against the establishment. It's almost a contest.
Everybody wants to not be establishment somehow, even if they live on Capitol Hill or they've been in Congress for 30 years.
Once again, Tamara Keith.
There's a reason that the Tea Party movement is called the Tea Party movement. From our very earliest days, Americans have been rebellious. Americans love both the underdog and the winner. We see ourselves in the nerd and the jock. Like, we want to be the jock and we respect the nerd. I mean, that's just, that's who we are.
So according to Tamara, America is both Emilio Estevez and Anthony Michael Hall, which makes sense given that our next reader is basically Ally Sheedy. As a teenager in the 1990s, Emiko Badillo waged her own campaign to tell the establishment, aka the cool kids, exactly where to stick it. She shared her teenage writings on stage at a Mortified event in Portland, Oregon.
I was what the other kids called weird. Because I usually wore black and listened to the Smiths and loved art and hated all of them. So, but instead of laying low and trying to be ignored, I spoke out loudly and often. I guess I just wanted them to know that I wasn't scared of them and that I was totally aware of what they thought of me. Like in my 11th grade English class, we all submitted writing for this anthology that the teacher published and gave out to all of us as a memento, the end of the year kind of thing. So here's an example of what other people were writing. This is called Symbols of Red. Someone wrote this. It's a poem, and they typed it out in a heart shape, okay? What is red? Red is the smell of roses blooming in the spring. It is the sight of our flag waving so proudly on the 4th of July. Red is the school color that we so proudly cheer for. Red is the color of Christmas, celebrating the birth of Jesus. Yeah. So now here's what I wrote. This is for all the suckers who have been hassling me from the dawn of time. For the past 3 school years, I've been at Taft High School. My journey through the halls of this prison have left me with a permanent sneer on my red lipstick face. Now, when these certain people look at me, most of them hate what they see, or at least wonder at me. Is it my problem that I don't want to be like them? All I know is that at least I'm very happy being who I am and not parading around like a god in a Letterman jacket with a beer in my hand, acting cool and making fun of the me's in the world. I would say some nasty and vulgar comments, but this is a school type assignment, so I can't. I usually do, but not in class. No, I do in class anyways. See, I know that deep down these people and I were carved from the same rock, and I accept that much about them. But the problem is that they don't realize that relation. At least I have some purpose in this place rather than being Miss Party USA. The reason I'm so weird, I think, is because I'm too soul-filled for them to comprehend. Here are some common myths about Emiko Badillo that I'm addressing to the people I've been affectionately writing about. Number one, she knows witchcraft. Well, maybe I do and maybe I don't. You'll just have to test me, right? Number two, she's really mean. Get her mad and she'll kill you. I get mad easily. Yeah, that's true. But that's because most people do the exact things that make me mad. Number three, she worships the devil. That's a bunch of something I won't say. How can I believe in Satan when I don't even believe in his biggest competition? Well, right about now, those people are subconsciously hating me because my raging brainwaves just penetrated their minds. They'll remember my name when they're in some stiff desk job with a life they hate, when I'm in People magazine for painting murals on the White House walls with the president's permission.
Sadly, Emiko's campaign to use her raging brainwaves to change the minds of the popular kids didn't work out. If only she had known actual witchcraft. Next, find out what happens when a teenager attempts to get elected Amigo del Año, as Mortified's totally juvenile election special continues. Welcome back to Mortified's Totally Juvenile Election Special. From the makers of the Mortified podcast, I'm Dave. And since we're talking this hour about the strange campaigns we waged as kids, I thought it only fair to ask our special guest, NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith, about a campaign that she waged as a kid.
I ran in junior high for student council president. That was not successful at all. And then in high school, I ran for the student representative on the adult school board position, which is quite possibly like the most nerdy student government. I mean, I know student government is kind of nerdy, but like take it to a whole new level. I ran to be able to sit at school board meetings every Tuesday night for my entire senior year of high school. There was actually competition, which is kind of shocking because who really would want to do that? I was up against this much more popular, put together girl, and I won.
And now that she covers campaigns as an adult, she's seen how other, more seasoned candidates handle stiff competition.
In a very crowded field, it's all about standing out. It's all about getting media attention. Airtime is oxygen. You want to have your thing. You're going to be the foreign policy candidate, or you're going to be the candidate who's tough on crime, or you're the candidate who tells it like it is.
This need to stand out applies to teenagers, too. Growing up in Chicago, Steve Sachs had big dreams. He wanted to run for office one day. But first, he needed a way to distinguish himself. He shared his teenage journals on stage at Mortified in Brooklyn.
I attended a small, preppy, private high school outside of Chicago. There I was a mediocre student and an ungifted athlete. So I was always in search of something that would make me stand out. Then in 10th grade, a group came to my Spanish class to recruit volunteers for Amigos de las Americas. This was a program that sent high school students throughout Latin America to do public health projects. I realized that this was my opportunity, especially when they mentioned that a local student had just won the coveted Amigo of the Year award, and he'd been interviewed on the local TV news. I vowed to become the next Amigo of the Year. You know, I wanted to think at the time that at least part of my motivation for doing Amigos was altruistic, that I had some penchant for helping those less fortunate, but this was not the case. I really cared only about myself. Then I got my assignment for the summer. I was going to one of the remotest areas of Mexico to dig latrines. June 15th, 1979. I consider myself a very special person. Someone who won't sell out just to make a lot of money, who will help the world's poor and underprivileged. I have this picture in my mind of me being famous, maybe winning the Nobel Peace Prize, and it making my entire family uncomfortable to be around me. June 17th. We went to this place to eat goat intestines with tortillas. It was a scuzzy meal. But we had been told in training to be culturally sensitive. My goal is to be the most culturally sensitive amigo in the entire program and to win the Amigo of the Year award. We returned to our auditorium to learn how to build latrines and to discuss the Amigos' rules, which are very strict. June 18th. Today we were alone with Mexican men who thought we knew what we were doing. But the truth was, I was sleeping through most of the lectures. We knew from the notes that the latrines had to be 15 meters away from water and 5 meters away from a house, but I didn't really know how long a meter was. June 25th. Jake and I were talking about the women around here. And he mentioned Doña Rosa's daughter, the foxiest Mexican woman I've seen yet. He told me she wants me so bad, but it's an amigo's rule that no one can have any amorous contact. And to Doña Rosa's daughter, no less, as I am a top candidate for the Amigo of the Year award, I will not break this rule. Billy and I then went to see Doctora Josefat. What began as an explanation of the Jeep incident turned into a conversation about sex, relaciones sexuales, abortion, el aborto, and contraception, anticonceptivos. It was a fascinating discussion. My Spanish was incredible. Thank you. And the doctora thought I was very bright. Later, I heard the sound of basketball. They had a dirt court with crooked rims. I showed them all my around the back between the legs layup, and I had a huge audience. They couldn't believe it. I loved it. June 26th. I've got to stop lying. It's a sickness. I told Ellen that I modeled in a Doubleman commercial when I was little. She asked if I'd ever been in Paris, and I said yes. Why would I lie about that? I told Stacy, who's looking really foxy, I had the opportunity to play racquetball with Sting and the police. I must control my lying because one day I will be an important diplomat or maybe a politician. July 10th. The project director had a group meeting. He found out about the drinking incident. Nothing would happen if we told him how much we drank. But something deep inside me told me to lie. I said I had a half a beer at lunch and felt very sorry. I think it was a Jewish Holocaust survival instinct. Since the 8 Gentiles got sent home and the 1 Jew, me, got to stay. So I thought I had gotten through the drinking incident unscathed and that I was still in the running for the Amigo of the Year award. But then the amigos who got sent home, they told Amigos headquarters in Houston that I'd lied about my alcohol intake. But I somehow convinced the staff to let me stay by promising to beat all previous latrine building records. But then the god of Montezuma had some more revenge. July 27th. I was awake after a sleepless and gaseous night. We reached the truck and piled in with 100 other people. 2 hours into the drive, I got these terrible stomach cramps. So yes, I had contracted dysentery. It was so bad, in fact, and I grew so weak that the locals strapped me to a donkey and sent me 4 hours to the nearest health clinic. When I returned home to the States, emaciated, I wondered if I'd done enough to achieve my summer's long goal. October 31st. Josh Weston won the Amigo of the Year award. I guess he started some library in his town in Costa Rica. I could have done that in 2 seconds. He wrote a letter supposedly from the family he stayed with talking about how amazing he was, and he had them sign it and mail it. I'm going to write an anonymous letter exposing his lies. Except for my drinking violation, I'm 10 million times the amigo he'll ever be.
And now Mortified presents Great Moments in Presidential Puberty with our special guest, NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith.
You know Franklin D. Roosevelt as one of our most accomplished presidents, but did you know that FDR was just as active as a teenager? On a road trip in Germany in 1896, he was arrested not once, but four times in one day. Among his crimes, picking cherries by the road and riding his bike at night. Who says crime leads nowhere? This has been Great Moments in Presidential Puberty.
This is Mortified's Totally Juvenile Election Special, a comedic look at the strange campaigns we waged as teenagers, from the makers of the Mortified podcast. There's an age-old idea in politics that being from a dynasty gives someone a leg up, witness the Roosevelts, the Kennedys, the Bushes. But it's not always a clear path to victory.
Generally speaking, legacies are both a liability and an asset. You have this political legacy and you've got the political machine, you know, the consultants, the donor base. The real challenge is defining yourself.
Hailing from a political dynasty in India, Chandrika Narayanan Mohan understood a thing or two about the need to create her own legacy. And that's because
my granddad was the 10th president of India. Realsies. Which could mean that I could, like, roller skate around a palace and have a Ferris wheel for my birthday party. That sounds, like, pretty cool. But these things went totally, like, over my head.
It was not your typical teenage life. She met world leaders, she studied multiple languages, she had a bodyguard following her every move at school. But like any teenager, Chandrika just wanted to be normal.
I wanted to live like the sort of shiny, fictional girls from Babysitter's Club. Because they had adventures and they had jobs when they were 11 and guys were like asking them out all the time. So like they seemed to have their lives totally sorted.
Then one day, her family left India and Chandrika set out to transform herself. She read her childhood writings on stage at Mortified in Dublin, Ireland.
By 13, I just moved to Sweden with my mom and I was studying at an international school. So this seemed like the perfect opportunity to start over and reinvent myself. But instead, I kind of struggled to adapt. And when I get sad, I tend to get just, you know, like a little bit dramatic. March 14, 2001. Apparently, it seems my life is going down the drain. I hate my school and I wish to go home. Sad is a world where one has to stop oneself from wishing for happiness for the sole reason that there is no such thing. Mankind is nothing to be proud of, but a dark, filthy stain on the carpet of the universe. Life is nothing but a winding path to death. Joy is a fake concept, for it will always have disastrous consequences. Smiles only lead to tears. One day, man will proudly take the final step forward, head held high and smug grin on its face, only to find it has been building a weak, disintegrating bridge and must now fall, along with all its work it thought was so great. Humanity is a waste of time and space. Farewell. In the future, I shall unearth this entry and do something great with it. Nice. So by 2002, I spent so much time just feeling totally sorry for myself that I couldn't even bear writing about it anymore. It's a bit of a gap. But then something changed. I turned 15 and decided to just go for it. I wrote a wish list. That would help me become a teen worthy of the Babysitter's Club. Things to do before I die. Get tattoo. Skydive. Get into a real fight and split my knuckles on a person. Get comfortably rich. Learn how to dance. Tick. Pet a cheetah. Make a really good band. Get hot. Tick. Smiley face. I still update this, by the way. Like, not all these things were ticked at the time. Like, I do it throughout my life. I wasn't this sordid at age 15. Have a guy buy me diamonds. Tick. It was my dad. Still counts. Be really, really smooth and have a lot of people witness it. Tick. Find true love and keep it. Italics underlined. Save someone's life. Throw a pie in someone's face. Buy the perfect pair of jeans. Tick. Be recognized. Tick. Become famous for my art. Jump from the roof of one building to another, underline italics, without dying. Wear a mini skirt in public and look good in it. Tick. Lose virginity. No. Okay, yeah, tick, it's grand. It's fine. Win a prize with lots of people there to witness. Tick. Drive. Tick. Drive a Ferrari. Walk alone into a crowded room and not be afraid at all. Tick. So, 14th February 2003. I just got back from the dance. I was the only one who didn't get to dance. I got rejected and was asked to hold a sweater. Alone and crying. I never thought that would be me, but it is. Why does nobody love me? Happy Valentine's Day. In 2004, at the age of 16, something finally happened that made me a happy teenager. 1st of March, 2004. First kiss! Holy mochaccino! Finally! Yeehaw! And man, this fun! I mean, I hadn't a clue what it would be like, and voila, I am now a makeouter. Well, for like a few minutes in various hallways, that is. I'm hoping I don't get carried away with my new discovery and seem clingy. And he said he's a bad kisser, but like I can tell. Nothing to compare to much. I wonder if I'm any good. Oh, Joe is the ultimate sweetheart. I am so in love. Naive first love, but hell, it's all the same. Love comes in different levels, but it's the same thing. I mean, it's like Jell-O in a small bowl and a massive mountain of Jell-O. Either way, it's still Jell-O. Weird comparison, but it's what came to mind. Life is good. Kissing is fun. I have homework to do. Adios. 15th May 2004. I broke up with Joe yesterday. I'm a wreck. Face it, I have too much love for it all to go on one person. It was also 3 weeks of pure bliss. Love is gorgeous pain and cosmic bliss, and it's beautiful.
Chandrika's mission to understand what it means to be a normal teenager continued throughout high school, her checklist growing larger with each day.
Be comfortable naked. Tick. Walk away from someone who you love but hurts you. Tick.
And eventually it hit her. That journey is exactly what defines a normal teenager.
September 11, 2004. I am not the same person I was 3.5 years ago. I grew up. I achieved and I failed and I got up again. It left me fallen and standing at the same time, broken and solid, confused and beyond certain. My name is Chandrika. My story is nowhere near over. Thank you.
Coming up, a teenager wages a campaign to warn her family of global catastrophe when Mortified's Totally Juvenile Election Special continues.
August 31st, 1998. Man, I have a lot to catch you up on. It's really weird. All the country's economies are collapsing. Chinese money is plummeting to worthlessness. In Russia, the president is trying to get rid of his cabinet and get a new one, but the communists won't consent to his new people. We've bombed Afghanistan and Sudan. I think we've declared war on the terrorists, and they declared war on us. And Iran or Iraq or some country like that is secretly making chemical and biological weapons. Or at least that's what our spies say. Oh well, in school news. Well, I love it.
Welcome back to Mortified's Totally Juvenile Election Special, stories of the strange campaigns we waged as kids. From the makers of the Mortified podcast, I'm Dave. And when it comes to watching the news, some kids get a little freaked out. Hence, kids of the 90s watch Saved by the Bell and not 60 Minutes. But there are exceptions.
I became completely obsessed with the 1992 presidential election. I was in junior high.
That's NPR's Tamara Keith confessing that she was one of those exceptions.
I don't know what was wrong with me. I just could not get enough. Ross Perot did his things with his like charts and graphs, and I thought that was fascinating. And then candidate Clinton did the town hall on MTV, which was amazing. And the boxers or briefs question was asked, which was, you know, I guess foreshadowing our current political climate where people tweet about deleting your account.
Headlines have an impact on kids. They can inspire them to action. In Tamara's case, a career.
I wanted to be Tabitha Soren when I grew up. She was the young female correspondent for MTV News. And now I am the reporter covering a very different campaign.
But for other kids, headlines can create a different call to action. In the case of Emma Jackson, watching the news turned her into like a teenage town crier concerned about a looming world crisis. And that's because in 1999...
Y2K was everywhere. I remember the news saying there would be no electricity, so the entire power grid would go down. That also means no airplanes. Cars would stop working because cars had computer chips in them. So we'd have to walk everywhere or get horses or something like that.
Okay, so quick history lesson. In December of 1999, one of America's biggest fears was a coding error that lurked in every computer. The fear? The internal clocks on the world's leading computer systems weren't designed to count beyond 1999. So at midnight, January 1st, 2000, they'd revert to January 1st, 1900 and cause global pandemonium. Armed with this knowledge, Emma waged a campaign to convince her family the time to act is now. She joined Mortified on stage in Baltimore.
So I took it upon myself to make sure that my family was prepared. I did research on preparedness. I gave myself an official sounding title. I asked Jeeves how to write a professional business letter for my very professional Y2K memos, which I wrote and dropped into the mailbox of my own family's home, addressed to my parents and my siblings. And this is what they said. April 23rd, 1999. This is 8 months in advance of Y2K. Greetings. This letter is the first of many that will keep you well informed on the Y2K worries, shopping lists, and the status of your household. I will hope you find it informative and helpful. Since I have recently been elected the Y2K home manager of your area, I feel it is my duty to stay in touch. Please write me if you have any questions. By the calculations that a family of five, such as your own, should have at stock 5 gallons of water for each day, this comes to 150 gallons, plus enough water to supplement any pets to be saved by January 1st. Lastly, we need to think of others in times of crisis. Ideally, we should have enough surplus to help out 2 families besides our own. Please let me know your feelings on the subject. And if a further plan of action is necessary. Cordially, Emma K. Rogers, head of Y2K Home Management. September 5th, 1999. Greetings. The most important topic of this letter is the Rogers family's water storage capacity. At this time, you have 58 gallons worth of saved plastic bottles. That is enough for 11.5 days, allowing for only 1 gallon per person and none for pets. Food-wise, we are even more in the hole. As of now, we have 1 bag of rice and a couple of cans of soup. Mrs. Rogers, my mom, has suggested that if Y2K strikes, the main staple of the Rogers household should be rice and beans. With this in mind, two more large bags of rice would be nice, as well as buying cans of beans, of which there are none. Also, on the extra grocery list are canned soups that are not concentrated. Those that require water rob us of our precious, already depleted water supply. Do not take your food collecting lightly. Ladies and gentlemen, set your calendars for Sunday, December 19th. This day will be bottling day. Please do not plan anything else for this day. Sincerely, Emma Rogers, head of Y2K management. Okay, so I have to stop here and say that my adult brother just told me that when he was a kid, he thought these letters were coming from the government. You can't really blame him because out of what I can only describe as sheer supportive generosity, my parents let Bottling Day actually happen. As the day of the new year grows near, final preparations are being made for the possible Y2K bug and the problems that may ensue. I congratulate your family on being more prepared than most, as you may have seen on TV. Though it is difficult to prepare for something that may not even happen, you have taken the initiative to prepare. Right now, there are 80 gallons of water stored in your basement. If everyone is given 1 gallon each and pets are given a quarter of a gallon, there is enough water for 2 weeks and a day. In the event the power goes out, there are a few things we need to address. All refrigerated and frozen food will have to be eaten. Ice cream will be eaten first. Followed by the food in the freezer, and then the rest. If you have any more ideas or concerns, please contact me. The new year is only 2 days away. Cordially, Emma Kate Rogers, head of Y2K Home Management.
We were invited to a party in the neighborhood, which we drove to, which proves that my parents didn't think the car was not going to work. But we did bring extra flashlights. And we were at the party, and at the ball drop, we were like, five, four, three, two, one. And all the lights went out. And my heart soared. It just leapt in my chest. And I was like, yes. And everyone screamed. And then the lights came back on. And one of the dads was like, gotcha. Ha, ha, ha. And oh, I was just devastated. It was so sad. It was like, oh, it didn't happen.
So you can imagine my disappointment when the new year came and nothing happened. However, I had learned two important things. One, how to be prepared. Two, how to deal with disappointment. I may not be able to protect you, but if there's another emergency or a domestic policy disaster, I will share my beans and rice with you.
And now Mortified presents Great Moments in Presidential Puberty, with our special guest, NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith.
While attending private school, John F. Kennedy was a star student, athletic, well-liked, and voted most likely to succeed. But did you know the future president also excelled at pranks? Such as the time he blew apart a toilet seat with a firecracker. Luckily, his antics didn't flush his future goals down the drain. This has been Great Moments in Presidential Puberty.
We've reached our final campaign stop in Mortified's election special, and what better way to celebrate the overlap of politics and puberty than by highlighting the one thing that defines success in both worlds, likability.
We all want to believe that elections are about issues, but when you interview voters, the first thing they say is that they like their candidate. There's this thing called the beer test. If you just go back through recent history, the candidate who has won has been the one who seems like they would be way more fun to have a beer with, even if they don't actually drink.
Kids know the value of likability more than anyone. As a teenager, Angel Yao waged a campaign to gain friends in a way that few other kids dared. Whereas politicians use likability to win elections, Angel used an election to get kids to like her. She shared her teenage writings at a Mortified event in LA.
So when I was in junior high school, I felt really like alone and I couldn't connect with anyone at all. So then I remember watching the school elections and I thought, okay, if I did something different and if I didn't read from a piece of paper and just like spoke with my heart, I could win the election. And even if I don't win that 5 minutes on stage, that's when like people will notice me and know how witty and creative I am. And it'll be my time to shine. The position I ran for was called Queen's Superintendent Advisory Board Council. It was called CUSAC. I didn't run for president or vice president because that was too hard. So here's my speech. You know, I had this whole speech prepared. 2 pages, size 12, Roman times, but I don't think I'm gonna read it. And I ripped it up, and I threw it on the floor. Because I just realized, in order for me to be a representative, I do not want to read something off a piece of paper. And I wrote it on my index card. I was like, I can't memorize this. So I was secretly reading from my index card. Hoping. No, I'm just gonna come up here and say what I feel is needed. Because that is who I am. I bet 90% of you here in this auditorium have no idea who I am. Or have ever seen me before in your life. And by saying that, I guess I want you guys to approach me. I know I look mean / scary, but I'm not. I don't bite people. I really think that's what it's about. It isn't a popularity contest. It's voting for someone you believe that can do their job. I know I'm bad at public speaking, and that is why I'm gonna pump it up. I decided to use my songwriting skills, and I quickly learned 4 or 5 chords on the guitar, and this is my campaign song. Ooh, 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 ooh. Every time you eat a cow, every time you fall down and say ow, ooh, vote for Angel Yao. Every time a cat says meow, every time you point at a condom and say wow. Ooh, vote for Angel Yao. I know she's kind of shy and quiet, but she will do the job. Every time you face an Indian / Native American and say how. Every time you want to abbreviate California and say cow. Ooh, ooh, vote for Angel, yeah. Ooh. Angel Yao, She's running to be queen, superintendent, advisory council, representative right now. Right now. Thank you. No one clapped. Thank you for that. I did win. Thank you. So after my speech, I was like, oh, I'm going to be super popular. Everyone's going to come up to me and say hi. And it, you know, some people looked my way, but no direct, like, compliments. Like, but then I remember this one girl. She was, like, one of the smarter, prettier girls. And she came up to me, and she was like, wow, Angel, you got some balls. And I was like, I guess that's a compliment. I don't know. But I'll take it. So I didn't gain any new friends, but I did gain what every teenage girl wants, balls. Thank you.
And that concludes Mortified's Totally Juvenile Election Special, where we learned if you had the choice to relive an election season or high school, the answer is obvious.
Oh gosh, the election. High school was terrible, though I guess it was good preparation.
But most of all, we learned, as we do in every incarnation of Mortified, including the Mortified podcast, which you should totally download, that
we are freaks, we are fragile, and we all survived.
If you enjoyed this show, visit getmortified.com to discover Mortified events in your area. Click participate, and who knows, maybe you'll appear in our next radio special. Our production team for this special includes Kathy Tu, Eric Bass, Emma Speakerman, Neil Ketcher, and myself, Dave Nadelberg. Performances were produced for the stage by Jennifer Clark, Shada Granis, Julia Rossi, Kian Trainer, and Megan Holmes. Music by Gordon Bash, Alex Burke, Adam Smith, The Angel, and Zoe Rose Palladino. Additional thanks to Lance Roberts Studios, Will Dwyer, Aparna Kumar, Tamar Avishai, Stephen Chapaska, Helen Zaltzman, Martin Oswick, Sloan Korak, Madeline Kenyon, The Workman's Club, Littlefield, and the entire Mortified community. This has been a production of Mortified Media and Radiotopia from PRX. We now return you to intelligent conversations with people who care about, you know, the real issues. But first, this.
Thursday, July 21st, 1988. Last night, I stayed up late watching the Democratic National Convention. Mike Dukakis made his acceptance speech, which I saw the last 40 minutes of. Dukakis didn't really say anything except about our country and jobs, etc.